You want to go back to Emerson's? Which is where
all right. I wrote the script partly on King Vida's yacht.
Oh, how marvelous.
Yeah, off Catalina. Quite a lot of it. And the rest of it in Mexico. And I don't know what to say about it. I wrote the script and then we rehearsed it. Longer than I've ever rehearsed anything in a movie. Because it was a relatively small cast. And everybody, we worked very hard for, I think we were 5 weeks rehearsing.
Without
very long, nothing, just, you know, not on set or anything, no movements, just rehearsing. And then we recorded every scene, which I've often done, so that we remembered what we'd thought about it, so that when you came on the set, there was the way it ought to, we had decided it ought to sound, even if we were going to change our
minds. Oh, that's great.
And I've done that since a lot.
But save a lot of time.
It does. But also it gives you new ideas. You see what's wrong and everything. It's kind of a preview. You come fresh after a week or two and hear a new... Anyway, none of that amounted to much because it turned out that our... the camera work moved very slowly. Let's put it that way. In fact, the picture took longer to shoot than any picture I've ever done, instead of shorter, as it was planned. Anyway, the picture was very carefully planned.
You mean the setups and so on?
Well, I never planned setups, but people made the sketch artists made setups. I never paid any attention to them, but they like to do that. But I mean, we planned everything technically very, everything was very... well set up.
I was very interested in the use of the townspeople. As narrators.
As chorus narrating,
It was a radio technique in a way.
In a way, although I hadn't done that in the radio show, but it was a sort of a radio device in a way. And it had the narrator, who was no character, just a narrator, kind of conversationally, you know, anecdotal at the beginning. And it's something that I'd hoped to develop and do more in other pictures, and which I've done in some scripts, but never again and had a chance to do in movies that I've got to make.
The narrator that you played in, so to speak, in Amberson, it has the quality of, you know, the sort of, the storyteller, the man who's telling the story for
that's
everybody
right.
to hear.
That's right. And I like that for movies.
Oh, it's great.
And
but nobody ever does it.
No, and I wanted to do more. As I say, I have never had a chance to, and I'd like to.
And it's supposed to be uncinematic.
I know, it's a great, that's a yes. Yeah. Yes, it's a great, it's one of the cliches of, but that if you, the narration is uncinematic, it's nonsense.
Isn't your feeling about movies that whatever is effective is cinematic?
Of course, I don't. You know,
it works. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
And I think words are terribly important in talking pictures. It's not true that words don't matter. You know.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah.
And it's true that you get a bigger impact with whatever is visual, but that isn't to say that the words are all that incidental. I think there's an awful lot of talking in a lot of my pictures. I have no aversion to
a lot of talk. You know, Chaplin said, when somebody said to him, you know, you never have any interesting camera angles. He said, I don't need interesting camera angles. I'm interesting.
Well, he was right. He was right. He certainly was interesting, and he wasn't interested in the camera. He was interested in himself, quite properly speaking. A Chaplin picture was a vehicle for Chaplin.
Yes. And it had to be.
Yes,
he also said a thing which I think was a rule for himself. I'd like to know what you think of it. He said that comedy was life in long shot and tragedy was life in close up.
Nonsense. That just sounds like, I don't know what, you know, it's, I don't think much of that.
No, it works for him that way.
How? What does that mean?
Well, when you go back, and I think the theory being that when you show in a long shot a man walking down the street falls in a manhole, it can be slips on a banana peel or something, it can be, it's funny in a long shot. When you get in close, it stops being funny and becomes, you know, painful for the man. That being the theory, I think.
Sounds good. If you want to be accurate, comedy size is a medium full shot. A long shot is tragedy again, you know.
Yes, that's right. Some of the greatest shots are long shots.
The following discussion was about the French comedian Jacques Tati, who acted in and directed Mr. Hulot's Holiday and Mon Oncle and Jour de Fête, among others.
But there are performers who only work in full shot, like Tati, for example, who's only good in a full figure.
In a full shot, you're right.
You know.
You always think
who disappears when you move in.
Yeah.
He literally disappears. He fades off the screen as the camera comes in closer. Very strange.
Strange, yeah. Do you like him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Always in a very nervous way, waiting and hoping for him to be just a little better, but liking it all the time,
that's,
you know?
Perfect. That's the great, yeah. You just hope he'll get through this and make you laugh.
Yes.
There is that.
And he often does.
Yes.
It's, you know, it's part of the suspense that goes with a very gifted, talented, gifted amateur performance, you know. Mm-hmm.
Will it be a disaster or will it be
Will great? It be terribly good? And often it's terribly good with him.
Yeah.
I think he has a sort of genius at moments, you know. Has some kind of real greatness. But you just never know from one minute to the next what the action is going to be like.
Yeah. That long shot business, of course, the last shot of you in Falstaff is a good example of that. That wonderful shot where you're walking away. That small figure lumbering away at the, you know. I love that shot.
It was dangerous. I was afraid of a cliche on it because, you know, the rejected figure going away in a full shot. One rather shies away from it. Amberson's has more full shots in it than any picture I ever made. Long scenes played in very full.
By full, you mean?
Full. I mean full. That also means wide.
Wide. Full shots. Yeah.
I don't know. The parlance may have changed.
No, you're right. Yes, I just don't know.
Yeah.
No.
It's or wide. In other words, figures of the people.
Full figure
or and more.
Yeah.
And a great deal more with long dialogue scenes played in Amberson. More than any picture I've ever done.
There's not very many close-ups in it.
Well, there were only close-ups that I make are usually because I'm forced to. Not because
you
I like them
not
very
like
much.
Them.
I've just made a picture that's almost entirely in close-ups. I don't know much how else I could have made a story on a boat, you know. But I think it's always better to avoid them when you can. It's a sign of weakness on the director's part and of on the actor's part. We had always a saying in my troops, if you aren't better in that, I'm going to have to make a close-up. You know, and that the actor is made to feel comically ashamed if we have to move in on him, because any actor can act in a close-up, you know.
Really?
Yes, including Rin Tin Tin. You know, it's in the full shots that you separate the men from the boys.
Of course.
Your man Ford is the greatest example of that. You know, he's sure enough of a scene, and he just holds on it. There they are. He doesn't have to bang around. Now people are very nervous about it, the young directors, and everything is close. And, you know, they don't have any confidence in it unless they're, you know.
And they'll never hold a scene simply straight.
And huge heads, the Italians love particularly. Now, I just made a West Italian Western. The entire thing is done, you know, with a, you know, right under the lips and right above the eyebrows. That's the way that's the chic. And I think it's a terrible mistake because you don't see people in life that way.
No.
You very seldom get that close to anybody.
I don't know when.
You know,
when you're kissing, you close your eyes.
What are the two schools?
the open and closed.
Yeah. Yeah. But it does require a much higher standard of acting to hold a scene without lots of cuts and to play it without being very close. Mm. And I think it does require a stronger hand from the director and a great deal more skill and resourcefulness and presence from the actors.
At the end of this following exchange, Orson's comment about the director, Max Ophuls, is a reference to Ophuls' reputation for doing very complicated, intricate, and long dolly shots.
Preminger made a remark once, not your favorite director, but I thought it was an interesting remark.
I'm not really Preminger at all. No, I have great respect for him.
He said that ideally, if he could make a picture, he would not never cut. He would like a picture all in one take,
It will happen. That will come.
Yeah.
When tape is perfected and they stop putting film in the cameras, which is a thing that I saw in a kind of insane flash of ignorance when I first started. I said to Toland, isn't it basically ridiculous that the film is in the camera? And he said, yes. Eventually it will be a sort of electric eye. You're right. I remember one of our earliest conversations. Yes. We won't be carrying the film around. We'll just be carrying the lens, just the eye, and that will certainly come.
Oh, that's fascinating.
You know, and then we'll really, you'll have some camera movements that will erase Max Ophuls from living memory.
I love that you said that.
The movie of Amberson's is far less sentimental, isn't it, than the Tarkington book? It's sentimental in the bad sense, or is the book a good book?
Extremely good.
It is. I've never read it.
It's a marvelous book. And Tarkington, I think, is an extraordinary writer who is must be discovered again, because he did write some things that are not so much sentimental as dated in their attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
He's disappeared.
Yes,
but he
very old fashioned.
But he deserves to be taken much more seriously than he is. If Amberson's the movie has any quality, a great part of it is due to Tarkington.
I know that the language of the narrator, a lot of it is taken right from the book.
If not, and what isn't is a pastiche of his style.
Yeah.
Is an imitation of his style. And what I did is to write a third act and to photograph it, which was then cut out, as you know, which is not Tarkington, which takes it into a darker, harder dimension than his book does. But, ¿qué pasó? Los ojos. Un momento, paramos. Paramos. And the fact that I did that is not to undo some mistake in Tarkington. It just takes Tarkington into another, takes the story into a dimension that is not in the novel.
Yeah, it's different.
But it isn't a criticism of the novel or a correction of it. It's simply an extension of it.
Yes.
I can't pay enough tribute to that book or to Tarkington. There are many Tarkington books I would like to make movies of besides Amberson's.
Like what?
Oh, Christ, now you ask me. Let me answer that after I look back. I once bought every book of his and read them, everything he ever wrote. What I really did was buy all the books for a friend of mine and then borrowed them all and read them.
That's in San Francisco?
Yes, but the one there's one wonderful one about a group of American tourists in Egypt, which you think an entrancing movie.
Comedy.
Partly comedy and with a big sort of social villain in it, you know. Like,
yes.
He was awfully good at people who were great harm to those around them. Yes,
George,
yes. And of course, Alice Adams is a wonderful book, and I think made a good movie.
It was a good.
Yes,
Hepburn was awfully good in it.
Marvelous. Yes. She was marvelous in it.
Yes. Yeah. That was George Stevens made that.
Yeah. Sure. But he's a
very, very interesting writer. And the only trouble is a great deal of his stuff is, particularly in Gone Kids, is hopelessly dated by the fact that kids have changed.
You mean the Penrod story?
Yes, and all that kind of thing. There are no such kids anymore. But the stories themselves are marvelous and terribly funny. Wildly funny. But you just can't imagine kids like that anymore, you know.
And how come Twain isn't dated then, or do you think he is too?
Well, no, because Twain wasn't writing about children in a upper middle class or middle class atmosphere. He was writing, you know, he took them out of, put them into a kind of invented anarchistic world where those values only exist in parody.
Yeah.
And very much in the periphery. We're out in the wilderness and on the river and the caves and all the rest of it. We're not, you know, on Main Street under the shadow of the elms.
Yeah.
You know, so it's easier for it not to be dated. Also, Twain is a giant and Tarkington is quite a giant. I'm not suggesting that Tarkington is the same size writer.
No.
Although I would say that Tarkington wrote more good books than Twain did. Twain wrote more trash.
The Tarkington?
Yes.
In other words, Tarkington's lesser books are still pretty good.
Yes. And it's only the masterpieces of Twain that last. You can't read him except his masterpieces.
Yeah,
I can't. He's very bad. But you can read all kinds of Tarkington with great joy. He's a Meyer, you know, it's more in the event. And a great deal of grace. That thing we were talking about. Funny kind of.
The grace?
Yes, yeah. Funny kind of.
Which is the thing you admire most?
Yes.
That and grace?
Yeah. Gallantry, I suppose.
Well, isn't Anderson's as much the story of the end of a chivalry or the end of a gallantry
as
Chimes of Midnight is?
Yes. That's the thing. That's a theme that interests me, and I go back to from various sources.
I love the scene because of Cotton's ambiguity in his attitude toward the automobile. In the scene when he talks at the dinner table,
yes,
about it may very well be that the automobile has done this, and this feeling that perhaps it has, and being sorry himself.
Yes. Very much like my father, who was an early automobile maker and racer and friend of Tarkington. And there's a lot of my father in that character, both as Tarkington wrote it and as I did.
Yeah.
He comes at my father from the first author and the second.
In other words, sort of the inventor who has a nostalgia for the...
Well, he was a man. He was a very early automobile fellow, and he had a deep suspicion of what the automobile would do. He was fascinated by it and very much afraid of what it was going to do to the world.
Yes.
The basic device, not device, the basic intention of the picture was to make this golden world and then show what it turns into. And what is left of the picture is only the golden world and a kind of arbitrary ringing down of the curtain by a series of clumsy, quick devices. Because the bad black world that came was just too much for the people at that time, and I wasn't there to be able to fight for it. I remember that even Joe Cotton wrote me in South America and says, you have no idea how, now that we've seen the whole picture together with an audience, how terrifying and frightening the last part of the picture is. It's just too much for the audience. Even those people who had my interest at heart felt that I'd gone too far. I don't believe I had. That was what I wanted to do, was to, it was a very tough picture. And it's still in some ways I can think of it as in many ways what I like best or anything I've done, but it's completely absent from it is the thing that would have been its whole point.
I was going to say something out there, and it was sort of a fleeting, intangible thought. I'm going to try and put it into words, but the idea of the sort of silliness of a girl getting offended because a man falls into a base vial during a
is
so silly, and yet it becomes tragic in the picture. The idea becomes tragic.
Yes.
Somehow it's the frailty of people. That's what I think.
Yeah. And of that sense of sensibility of that time, too. Of
yes. Course. I guess it's the fragility of it.
That's it.
Well, the kitchen scene, you said, was improvised.
Yes. But not the material, what was said. It was just, it was improvised from material that had been discussed and given to the actors that they didn't memorize it.
But they knew where they were going.
That's right, exactly. But it wasn't truly improvised in the sense that they made up a scene.
Mm-hmm.
The real improvising would mean that they didn't know what the scene was going to be, and it turned out that way. They knew exactly. It's just they made up the words for a scene that had a very precise shape before we began.
And is that where you... That's how the...
Even some of the lines were already settled.
It was just...
It was very... it was loose in that sense. But it was loose.
And it wasn't set exactly where somebody would take a bite or eat the cake or whatever she was doing. He was eating the cake. And
sort of. It's very hard to explain. In a way, it was. The rhythm of it all was set. It's just the precise words weren't.
Yes. You worked very hard at what seemed very carefully set up, the whole background, the utensils, the way they were hung.
Is the scene in the railway station still in?
Between
Ray Collins
and Ray Collins,
that's a
great scene. When he tells him what he thinks of him.
Yeah, before he goes off.
Yes.
I'd forgotten where that was at.
And that scene I love because Ray Collins is so simple about it. He's not like his telling off scene. It's just like telling him absolutely what he's always known, and he doesn't even dislike him for it.
Yeah. Kind of family scene. He was terribly good in that, I thought.
Ray Collins?
Yes.
I thought he was great in the picture. That bathtub scene was very good. But that's how you, in fact, achieved the sort of feeling of spontaneity in that scene, where they were sort of walking in each other's lines a couple of times, and not an overlap, but sort of just like they came in at the wrong time, but it was very natural. It wasn't...
But like very carefully rehearsed.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Rehearsed mistake, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about the scene on the stairs, the scene between Tim Holt and Agnes Moorehead where they're going up the stairs, which I think was without a cut or something.
Yeah, it grinds up at the door, doesn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What about it? I don't know. There it is. That sounds mean-spirited. I just don't know what to say.
Well, the staircase was a dominant feature in the film. It was sort of dominated that whole part of the film. There's that great scene when you see her up there and he's in the middle and he's pan up and I guess maybe staircases are of that era, and so it dominates your memory of the film.
And they're great. They were great elements in a pompous house. Kind of the heart of a pompous house with its pompous staircase. You know, and of course it's a meaningless thing in a house. It's just something to go up and down. It's just, it's that imitation palace business.
Yeah.
Really, these people haven't got anything, any royal progresses to make, but it's built as though it, And I had great aunts and the grandmother and all kinds of people who lived in houses exactly like that. My grandmother's house had a ballroom on the top floor exactly like Amberson's, which was
the top floor.
Yes.
top floor was the ballroom.
Yes.
Not the attic floor. This is the third floor was the ballroom. And she then changed it to an indoor golf course. At some stage, or somebody did, her second husband, I guess, must have. And I remember visiting it and seeing it, seeing this terrible green felt, little hills built all over the...
The ballroom.
All of the ballroom. Mm.
The ball scene was, must have been rehearsed for a long time.
Yes, of course. Well, everything was. Well, then the ballroom, technically, of course, was a big job, yes. But not as hard as you might think, because the sets were built for it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go into a set and then say, let's do this ballroom. The whole thing
was built
for
the kind of movement.
Yes.
Kind of camera
movement.
Yes,
and all that was planned before it was built, so we didn't have to wonder what we'd do. We knew that this wall was going here and this wall was going there and everything before we started.
Yeah. I love the moment. But the scene when she dies... The mother dies, and the way you convey that is heartbreaking. Moment when she just says she loved you, George, and you fade out on it immediately.
It's hurt by the fact that they cut the scenes in which she's sick and is brought home.
No, some of that's there.
Some of it, but arbitrary, and it was very long and moving, the scene where she was brought back to the house. It was extended scene,
mm-hmm.
and it made that sharp thing much more effective because mm-hmm.
there was a sort of big sustained
thing before it.
Mm-hmm.
It was music, I don't know, it worked better with the length that it had before, mm-hmm. bringing her home through the streets.
I remember the scene with the mother writing a letter and her lips don't move, you know, you hear her voice and she says, you're devoted, you know, and then you cut to Tim and he finishes the letter, you know, sort of economy of cutting was something that you did.
They do it quite a lot nowadays.
Now,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, then it wasn't, it was not at all typical of movie making, but it was a radio.
Not really. It was, you can't be that economical on radio. You have to be a little more formal because there's only the one dimension of the ear, you know.
You don't know who's talking necessarily.
Yes, yes. You have to be more formal and more careful. But we did a lot of things like it in radio, as far as you could go. And develop, you know, it certainly helped me to think in that direction. Because I used a lot of letters and narration and everything in radio. An enormous amount, much more than anybody else did. Any other radio writers or producers.
The scene when you go through the town with George and Lucy and the horse and buggy, that's Tim Holt.
Yes.
Was that originally intended to be a back projection?
No, never.
How on earth did you do it?
Well,
it must have been the longest set in the world.
Well, it's just that RKO back lot. We didn't build anything. It's just everything that was standing.
Yeah. The street was there.
Yes.
And you redressed it.
Yeah, that's all.
That seems so long.
Yes.
It must have been half a reel, wasn't it?
It's a long, long scene. Yes, there they ride, no cuts, and they just ride along.
And the other side of the street is reflected in the...
Yes.
Which, again, did they have both sides of the
street?
Yes. You just did it?
Yes. Mm. You used the reflections instead of tried to avoid them the way people do. Then there's an in-joke there. You can see Jack Holt is playing at a local movie, if you look carefully.
I know. Yeah, I was going to ask you about
Tim
that,
happy.
Which is actually sort of an anachronism.
Yes, of course it was. It was too early, but just to make Tim happy.
Yeah.
Of course it was an anachronism.
That's a great scene.
He was extraordinary in it.
He was extraordinary.
And he's marvelous to work with. He's one of the most interesting actors that there's ever been in American movies. And he decided to be a cowboy actor. You know, he made two or three very important pictures in his career, always spaced out. And his decision was not to go that direction and go back to the bread and butter westerns and have that kind of life.